Translation. O Sudarshan Wheel, you are religion, you are truth, you are encouraging statements, you are sacrifice, and when you are the enjoyer of the fruits of sacrifice, you are the maintainer of the entire universe, and you are the supreme transcendental prowess in the hands of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You are the original vision of the Lord, and therefore you are known as Sudarshan. Everything has been created by your activities, and therefore you are all pervading. Purport by Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. The word Sudarshan means auspicious vision. From Vedic instructions, we understand that this material world is created by the glance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Saya Ekshita Sa Ashrijita. The Supreme Personality of Godhead glanced over the Mahatattva, or the total material energy, and when it was agitated, everything came into existence. Western philosophers sometimes think that the original cause of creation was a chunk that exploded. If one thinks of this chunk as a total material energy, the Mahatattva, one can understand that the chunk was agitated by the glance of the Lord, and thus the Lord's glance is the original cause of material creation. Umagyanti marandasya gyananjana shalakaya chaksur unmilitam yena tasma shri guruve namaha jai shri krishna chaitanya prabhu nityananda shri advaita gadadhar shivasari gaura bhaktavinda hare krishna 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 hare 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 rama 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 hare 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 krishna. So before I start, I just want to ask all the devotees for their blessings, especially the senior devotees present, so I can say something pleasing to Srila Prabhupada and the deities. It's my first Srimad Bhagavatam class, so I'm not very qualified, but I've been asked by the devotees to say some words, so I will try my level best. Hare Krishna. So just to give a bit of a context to what we just discussed. So Maharaj Ambarish, he was observing Dwadashi, which is one day after Ekadashi. So basically, he was about to break his fast. And at that time, Durvasa Muni arrived. So the etiquette is that when a guest arrives, you treat him as good as God. There's a saying, it's Atithi Deva Bhava. You treat your guest as good as God, as a representative of God. So the etiquette is you welcome him into your house, you offer him prasad or glass of water, etc. So he invited Durvasa Muni. But Durvasa Muni said, yes, fine. And then he said, but I need to do some of my daily rituals. So he went to the Yamuna to do that. So because Maharaj Ambarish had to break his fast, because time was passing, and you have to do it at a certain time, otherwise your fast doesn't really count. So he spoke to brahmanas to get advice, and they said, you know, you can drink water, because technically it breaks your fast, and in another way it doesn't. So he thought, okay, this is a good idea, so, you know, I'll do that. So Durvasa Muni, by his mystic power, he was able to understand what's happened. So when he reached Maharaj Ambarish's palace, he became very angry. He just started to chastise him. He pulled out from his pluck of hair a fire demon. And this fire demon came towards Maharaj Ambarish to kill him. Now, Maharaj Ambarish, you know, when he saw this, he wasn't scared, he wasn't disturbed, he was just standing there. So as soon as that happened, then the Sudarshan Chakra came and destroyed the fire demon. And then the Sudarshan Chakra started to chase Durvasa Muni. The Durvasa Muni, being a mystic yogi, he started to travel to different planetary systems to escape the Sudarshan Chakra. He had nothing that could protect himself from the Sudarshan Chakra. So he went to Lord Brahma's planet. Lord Brahma said, look, I can't help you. You know, it's beyond my power. So then he went to Lord Shiva's planet, in Shivloka. Lord Shiva said, look, I can't help you either. So then he went, then finally he went to Vaikuntha. He went to the spiritual world and he went to see Lord Narayan. And Lord Narayan, instead of helping him, he started to glorify his devotee. And said, look, I can't help you. You've offended my devotee. You need to go to a Maharaj Ambarish and beg for forgiveness. So he took heed of the instruction and he traveled quickly to Maharaj Ambarish with the Sudarshan Chakra behind him. And the Sudarshan Chakra, because of its heat, it was basically burning him. So this journey because it happened in Vrindavan, to go to Lord Narayan's planet and back was 1 year. So it's explained that, you know, Maharaj Ambarish still hadn't broken his fast. He'd waited for 1 year for Durvasa Muni to return. So then as soon as he saw Maharaj Ambarish, he fell at his feet begging forgiveness with the Sudarshan Chakra literally behind him, ready to kill him. And Maharaj Ambarish saw this and he started to recite prayers that we just chanted. Just to explain, Sudarshan Chakra, as we know, is not just a weapon of Krishna, of Lord Vishnu. It's an eternal associate. It's a personality. It has a form. And Sudarshan Chakra appears in many pastimes of the Lord. It appears in Krishna Leela, when he killed Shishupal. It appears when Krishna took Arjuna to see Mahavishnu. He used the Sudarshan Chakra to illuminate the material universe because it was so dark. And it also appeared in Chaitanya Leela when Lord Chaitanya was ready to kill Jagaya Madai. If you go to India, and there's certain places in India, they have temples where this chakra is worshipped. I haven't been to any of those, but I've heard people have been there. And also if you go to New Rajadam, you'll see it there as well. They have a deity of Sudarshan Chakra. And I've also heard that in Krishna Leela, when Krishna is performing his pastimes, it's explained that the Sudarshan Chakra is hovering above Vrindavan to protect it. So Prabhupada also says Sudarshan means auspicious vision. Su means auspicious, Darshan means vision, seeing something. So Prabhupada is talking about Mahatattva in the purport. So when Lord Vishnu, he glances upon something called Pradhan. Pradhan is described to be, it's actually very difficult to describe actually. It's described as undifferentiated, unqualified, unknowable. It's just inert, nothing's happening there. It's not active. So Lord Vishnu, he glances upon the Pradhan, and it's explained that when he glances, he impregnates it with jiva, with karma and kala, time. And the personification of that glance is Lord Shiva, Shambhu. It's explained elsewhere that Lord Krishna is aloof from his material energy. He doesn't become contaminated by it. So Lord Shiva, he takes up that role. He takes up that role to interact with the material energy. That's why sometimes Lord Shiva is considered to be the father of the material world, and his wife Parvati is considered to be the mother of the material world. And this causes Pradhan to transform, the three modes come about, and everything becomes active. And actually, it's actually very difficult to describe Pradhan. Like, I just used three words: undifferentiated, unqualified, unknowable. But it's very difficult to describe. It's like the Mayavadis, when they try to describe Brahman, they say it has no qualities, it has nothing. But, you know, it's a bit like that. But Pradhan is, you know, it's very difficult. And the scientists are also trying to study it. You know, they go down to the most basic level. They go to levels of, I guess it's called quarks, or on the atom level, and they don't understand it. And they haven't even got to the level of Pradhan. So scientists will always be confused about how to ascertain reality, because they're using tools, they're using their intelligence, which is within which is limited by time, space, and matter, to understand something of that level. It's not even, and Pradhan is not even transcendental, because it's within the material universe. They don't have the tools for it. And it's just like, you know, it's just like Prabhupada gives the example of the frog, you know. The frog is in the well, and he's trying to Someone's describing the ocean to it, and the frog says, oh, is it bigger than the pond? But the pond, the frog has no perception, no conception of how big an ocean is. So they're just like ants trying to understand the material universe. What to speak of understanding the spiritual world, God. And there's so many speculative theories. If you see, you know, there was a theory that the universe was flat, the universe was round, there was only one country. There are so many theories if you study it. And it was purely based on speculative theory. So they're just trying to act like authorities. And if you, there's a pastime in Krishna Lila where there was a king called King, I can't pronounce it properly, I think it's King Pundrik. So he basically, you know, he went to Krishna's planet. He said, you know, I'm Krishna. So then everyone started laughing at him. You know, he said, I'm the supreme, absolute truth. And they all laughed at him. And finally, Krishna killed him. So scientists are also like that. They're trying to be the supreme authority, the supreme absolute truth. You know, we give you the highest knowledge. And Krishna's like he was laughing at Pundrik, he's also laughing at them, thinking, you know, you'll never understand me. And, you know, sometimes he empowers them to become more, fall more into ignorance. Because Krishna, you know, because everything comes from Krishna. Krishna says, sarvasya chaham hridi sani vishto smritir gyanam apanam cha. Knowledge, remembrance, forgetfulness comes from him. So, you know, we should be grateful to Prabhupada. You know, he's made it very clear in explaining how material nature is created, why it's created. You know, he's gone really into it. He's really broken it down in the purport. And if you look at different religions, they also struggle to explain creation. Like one religion says the earth was created in 6 or 7 days. The other religion says God just created the universe. But there's not much information. It's not very scientific. It's just very vague. Whereas when Shukadeva Goswami described it, it's very elaborate. It's very scientific. There's so much knowledge there. You know, you can study it for days, months, and still not fully understand it because there's so much information there. So different religions find it very difficult to explain and argue their point on how creation comes about. So we can, unfortunately, we're not in this situation. We can argue, we can explain the situation much better than others. So going back to when Durvasa Muni fell at Maharaj Ambarish's feet. Explained that Maharaj Ambarish felt great pain. He was embarrassed at this great Muni falling at his feet because naturally he's a very humble person. And actually he wasn't offended in the slightest when Durvasa Muni tried to offend him, was chastising him and tried to kill him. He didn't feel anything because he was a fully surrendered soul to Krishna. And he didn't feel any anger, enmity. You know, but the only one thing he did feel was mercy towards Durvasa Muni. He felt, you know, this person still hasn't eaten yet, you know, and now Krishna's Sudarshan Chakra wants to kill him. So mercy is one of the 26 qualities of a devotee, and it's a very powerful quality. So like I explained, Maharaj Ambarish waited 1 year for Durvasa Muni to return just before he could break his fast. It shows how much respect he had for him. And you know, before this explained, when he started his fast, he waited 1 year. Now he's waiting another year, because such was the etiquette. So these verses, these glorifications are describing the greatness of Maharaj Ambarish. Actually, so many qualities, and it's explained that you know, there's the nine angas of bhakti: shravanam, kirtanam, Vishnu smaranam. And there's a personality that represents each of them, but Maharaj Ambarish has all of them. Durvasa Muni, on the other hand, he's a great mystic yogic. He's very famous for getting angry. He's very famous for giving curses and boons. And he's quite unique because even though, you know, it's hard to explain whether he is a pure devotee, whether he's a mixed devotee, but he's associated with Krishna, his avatars, and you can go to the spiritual world. It's from this, what we just read, he just, you know, he could just go there. So he's very unique. But he also gets very angry, and he's very famous for that. You know, there's a story when he was taking the sages to the Pandavas, and they didn't have any they didn't have anything to feed the sages. So Krishna, he ate one rice, and then immediately all the sages were satisfied, because they were worried that Durvasa Muni would get very angry. One thing that was interesting was that Durvasa Muni's powers, you know, he had powers that he had acquired through his austerity, through his pious activities. But when they came before Maharaj Ambarish, they were very insignificant. And Maharaj Ambarish, he had also had powers, but they weren't his. They were coming from Krishna. So this is the difference. So Durvasa Muni had acquired it through his pious activities, and Maharaj Ambarish, he'd acquired his through Krishna. And Durvasa Muni's was insignificant in comparison. So like I explained, he was, when this demon came towards Maharaj Ambarish to kill him, he wasn't scared. He didn't even lose composure. He was just fully surrendered. He didn't really care, to be honest, because it didn't really bother him. And and this same principle, if we study Krishna's devotees in Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's quite prevalent. You know, one quality is that the devotees describe, they don't proactively go out to protect themselves against curses, against demons. They just depend on Krishna. They say, Krishna, just save us, protect us. And Krishna comes. Just like Prahlad Maharaj, when he was being killed by his father. You know, you don't see him being scared or screaming, or, you know, he just totally surrendered. Haridas Thakur, you know, when he was being beaten, he didn't really go out of his way to protect himself. He just accepted his situation. So, you know, Prabhupada, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishnadas Kaviraj has described 26 qualities of a devotee. I just wanted to read it because it's nice to just mention it. And it helps us to distinguish between who's a devotee and who's a non-devotee. I'll just read it. He's 26 qualities of a devotee. He's very kind to everyone. He does not make anyone his enemy. He is truthful. He is equal to everyone. No one can find any fault in him. He is magnanimous. He is mild. He is always clean. He is without possessions. He works for everyone's benefit. He is very peaceful. He is always surrendered to Krishna. He has no material desires. He is very meek. He is steady. He controls his senses. He does not eat more than required. He is not influenced by the Lord's illusory energy. He offers respect to everyone. He does not desire any respect for himself. He is very grave. He is merciful. He is friendly. He is poetic. He is expert. He is silent. Obviously, silent doesn't mean he doesn't say nothing. It means he just speaks about Krishna. He doesn't speak about mundane things. So here we have like a perfect description of a fully perfect surrendered devotee. With such definitive, clear information, there's no room for speculation as to who is truly surrendered and who's not, and who's a devotee and who's not. And it's explained in Bhagavad Gita that it's explained that the qualities of a devotee, the demigods, are automatically within a devotee. And it's not that a devotee is a hypocrite. He says one thing and does it another. So it's like, you know, I remember when I was young, when I was about 10, 11, and it was the culture then, he started to smoke. And I remember his mother found out. His mother said, you shouldn't smoke. But then she'd be smoking at the same time. Then I thought, you know, how much effect is that going to have? It's, you know, it's hypocritical. And, you know, so to preach to someone, you've got to be living it yourself. You know, there's a famous story of Mahatma Gandhi when he met, you know, this mother took her child to see Mahatma Gandhi and said, you know, my son is eating too many sweets. Can you please tell him not to? So Mahatma Gandhi said, you know, wait, we'll do this, come back later in a few days, and I'll tell you, then I'll speak to your son. So she brought him back, then he preached to the son, you know, you shouldn't eat sweets, it's not good for you, etc., etc. And then after this, the child naturally stopped speaking. Stopped eating sweets, sorry. And then the mother said, Bruno, why didn't you just say it the first time I came? So Mahatma Gandhi said, Problem was, I was also eating sweets. So I have to, you know, practice what I preach. So devotee is like that. He practices what he preaches. He's not a hypocrite. And it's very condemned. Prabhupada didn't like hypocrisy. So another quality I was looking at in Maharaj Ambarish was forgiveness. You know, he wasn't offended in the slightest. You know, he didn't think anything really happened, to be honest. If anything, he was full of compassion, full of mercy for Durvasa Muni because of what he was going through. So as we know, forgiveness is a very powerful tool. It empowers one to release pain and grow from and we can also grow from that experience. And, you know, we shouldn't really hold grudges. You know, in some communities, some Asian communities, you know, if one member of a family argues with another member of the family, that enmity will go on through generations and generations. And people, they kind of glorify that in some cultures, say, this shows, you know, you shouldn't mess with these people, you know. It's, you know, they'll keep it throughout their lives. And I've heard people say, you know, it's kind of like a glorification, but actually, it's actually quite low class. It's quite Shudra mentality to keep that type of enmity. Like, and then your future generations take up the mentality when they don't even know the two people personally who argued, you know, had nothing to do with them, but they'll carry on that mentality. You know, we see Vidura, he forgave Dhritarashtra, you know, after Dhritarashtra's son humiliated him, kicked him out of the kingdom. Vidura forgave him. He didn't hold anything, though he didn't forget, but he didn't hold any grudges. And nice, I was reading this story yesterday about a community in America. It's the Amish community, and basically in 2006 there was this person, Matt, and he, you know, his family knew the Amish community. Amish community is like a very, how can I describe it? The community that they're dressed very simple. They use carriages. They don't use modern technology. They're like, you know, they're like living in the 19th century. So basically, one crazy person, he took 10 of their children from their community and locked them into this kind of like this room or something, and he killed five of them. Five of them were seriously injured. So these were children. And it's explained that the Amish community, you know, they were grieving, they were in pain. But then as part of their philosophies to practice forgiveness, they went to this person, because that gunman, he turned a gun on himself and killed himself. So the Amish community went to his funeral to grieve with the family. And once they did that, they also went to that person's wife, because she had lost her husband, and said, look, you know, we don't hold any grudges against you. If anything, we're ready to look after you. And they, you know, they kind of welcomed her into the community, and not just the wife, the mother as well. And I was just thinking on this, you know, it's like someone's just taken away your children, killed your family members, and if anything, you know, in those type of situations, you know, you don't want nothing to do with the person. It's family. You know, especially you don't want to invite them into your house. But these people were willing to invite them and look after them, because this lady had no person to look after her. And I thought that's such an amazing example of forgiveness. Now, I don't want to paint like a rosy, make it sound easy, because forgiveness does take time. You know, can be a gradual process for some people. So I think if we can practice at a very beginning level, basic level, then naturally it will become very easy when we come to even greater difficulties in our life. And even in our families, our friends, even devotees will sometimes apparently offend us. And we should, we should come to that level where, you know, it just kind of flicks off us, you know. Like I remember when I was in school, and, you know, our teacher would always say, you know, there was that childhood saying, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, but word calling will never hurt me. And I was thinking, that's just a stupid thing, you know. Who's gonna believe that? You know, it was like a glorific. If you could put the other person down when they did it to you, that was like a big thing. But having think about it, it was such a profound. It was simple, but it was such a profound thing, you know, just following that principle, you know, just being detached from it, just forgiving the other person. So these are some of the things I got from reading this. I just wanted to finish here, and if any of the devotees would like to give any comments, give more insight, if they have any questions...